Thank you for that wonderful introduction, and thank you all for your attention, and good morning to you. It's a tremendous honor to be speaking to you all this morning. Stan Evans is a good friend of mine. He's a professor at, or he was a professor for about 30 years at Troy University, and it's a shame he's not here this morning, but an honor to be on a stage that that Stan has been so actively involved in over his career as well. I'm to talk this morning about the road forward in economics, and I feel a little squeamish about doing that because we're not in economics very good at forecasting, okay? And the road forward implies I know something about the future. Economists are really bad when it comes to understanding or predicting the future. Back in 2008, for example, about 60 economists were asked, what is the economy going to be like in 2008? Okay, so they were asked at the beginning of the year, what do you expect for growth this year? And the average forecast was about 2.5% positive economic growth. Of course, 2008 was the worst year for economic growth that we've seen since the Great Depression. Turned out to be about negative 5% real growth that year, and we all were wrong, okay? Did we learn from 2008? Not really, okay? We still go on forecasting and predicting all kinds of things that turn out to be wildly wrong. For example, in 2008, President Obama and his team of economic advisors put together a prediction of what stimulus would do for the economy. And they put this really wonderful graph together of what stimulus would look like, what the unemployment rate would look like if we had stimulus, and then what it would look like if we didn't have stimulus. And now we have about 5 years to kind of plot reality against what actually has happened, okay? And many of you have probably seen this chart. They were nowhere close. Their predictions were wildly wrong again. So to talk to you all about what's happening in the world today, or what's happening in the world of economics today, is something that I'm hedging significantly and saying, I could be wrong, okay? So that's a lesson that's very important, one that I think weaves and can be traced back to Milton Friedman from 50 years ago. He was here 50 years ago talking on a topic, a theme, liberalism, and he was really hung up, if you go listen to the recording, that liberalism was in quotation marks. He spends a couple minutes at the beginning like, why did you put this in quotation marks, liberalism? But in his panel, he was talking about the need for humility and the need for admitting that sometimes there are things that we don't know. Okay, and in the world of economics, we don't do a very good job of this. In fact, even since getting the recession wrong, the Great Recession of 2008, what it's led to in the discourse within economics is largely just a doubling down on both sides. Okay, so those who think that the crisis was due to too much government have really doubled down and said it was due to too much government, and they're screaming. Okay, they're essentially screaming at people who are in favor of more stimulus and more action. So you have Paul Krugman screaming on one side, okay? You've got a number of people, a little more disorganized, arguing on the other. And there's not a lot of humility in these contemporary discussions. It's, I'm right, okay? And back and forth. And as Dan said last night, Dan Henniger last night said, it's just this constant chirping. And the chirping gets really loud, and it's really easy to say things in big capital letters on tweets that make it clear you're yelling, okay? I don't tweet, but I've understood that, I guess, if you put things in capital letters, you're yelling, okay? So with all of that, just kind of as preliminary comments about the future out of the way, I wanna talk a little bit about where economics is at the moment by first talking about the past. I have a three-year-old at home. I read books to her every night. When I end talking about books, she asks me to tell her a story. One of my favorite stories to tell her is that on the night she was born, she made it 36 minutes into June 5th, okay? On the night she was born, okay, she stuck around in her mommy's belly just long enough to be born on the day of Adam Smith's birth, okay, which is pretty awesome. So my favorite story, okay, my favorite story to my daughter begins with a long time ago, almost 300 years ago, another wonderful man was born just like you, okay? And his name was Adam, okay? Long live Adam Smith, all right? And Smith, I think, is extremely important in trying to frame where economics is at today. He's the father of our discipline. He single-handedly is responsible for just framing what economic science should be about. It should be a focus on well-being. It should be a focus on the human condition. It should be a focus very broadly on big ideas, okay? And that Smithian theme is something that we see throughout the history of economics. People basically filling in the questions and the gaps in Smith. Certainly Milton Friedman was doing that 50 years ago when he was talking to this group. He was very much a Smithian through and through in his work, in what he was doing. And there still was this focus on the big questions, okay? How can we improve human well-being? I mean, if you wanted to summarize what is Friedman about, that's it, more or less, okay? How can we improve human well-being? Fast forward from Smith, Friedman, to 2014, and here's what economists are now talking about. Here's just a sampling of the latest leading economics journal. Ambiguity aversion with three or more outcomes. I have no idea what that means, okay? No betting Pareto dominance, okay? The only word I really understand in there is Pareto, okay? Autoregressive roots and predictive regression, okay? On transitional costs of sectoral reallocation, okay? I'm sure these are fascinating, deeply fascinating questions and papers, and I'm sure the authors put in a tremendous amount of time. That's scientific progress in one sense, is that the questions we're asking are getting more and more refined. We're honing in on something, okay? But the discipline of economics and what a lot of it is honing in on is something that, quite frankly, the world could care less about, and that most of us practicing economics could care less about, myself included. The average number of people reading these papers in economics, autoregressive roots and predictive regression, is around 2, okay? Swear to God, okay? This is something that is actually confirmed in other interesting papers. Like, well, let's look at how many people read these papers. 2. That paper got read by more than 2 people, by the way, okay? So what I'm trying to say is that if we look broadly at the state of economics, where it is today, okay, it's a pretty dismal place. Not surprising, since we're the dismal science, all right? It's a discipline as a whole, where there are some interesting conversations happening, but a lot of it is actually driven just by tweaks, okay? Very small marginal contributions, and conversations that frankly are, look at a wall drying boring, okay? Like watch the paint on a wall dry boring. They're not Friedman-esque questions, and they certainly aren't Smithian questions about the wealth and well-being of people, how to actually make people better. And that's a shame, okay? Because every resource that we're focusing on boring questions, the elasticity of demand for cigarettes in the years 1950 to 1953 is just a misuse of resources, okay? It's resources that could have instead been used to focus on things like poverty in Africa, which is still at about 30% of the population living on less than a dollar a day, okay? It's a complete misuse of resources in that we could be focusing on issues that are just fundamental and that this group is largely focused on. So while the discipline of economics as a whole is, in my opinion, in really rough shape, okay? Rough shape also because the scientific method being used almost completely across the top of the field is just a one-size-fits-all method. So if you go to a workshop, the standard treatment in economics, it's everything is exactly the same. Here's my data, here's my model, here are my results. And that's it. That's the only way you can play the game. And my friend Deirdre McCloskey has pointed out that this form of science, or what we call science in economics, is actually way behind where the humanities are and where art is and where much of the rest of the world is. We're still stuck in like the 1950s in terms of the way that we try to do science, and there's been a lot of change since then. So to talk about the state of economics, I think, is somewhat hopeless. If you look at what all of this research is doing in terms of the outcomes we're seeing in terms of agreement and disagreement, all you need to do is look 3 weeks ago at a minimum wage discussion between those who are maybe on my side, okay, and those who aren't. You get 400 economists on each side signing letters saying we should abolish the minimum wage, we should raise the minimum wage. And anyone who's a non-economist says, what the hell's going on? Like, how can there be 400 on each side of this, all right? It's classic, on the one hand, on the other hand, economics that frustrates almost everyone who's not in it. So the discipline as a whole is spinning, okay? It's spinning. We don't have a great explanation for the financial crisis. We aren't really doing all that much that's positive and exciting in terms of affecting the question Smith and Friedman were interested in. With all of that said, okay, it is the morning, and I don't want you all to just be very cynical. I think that within economics, there's a pocket of work that's really exciting, and that's what I want to focus my remaining time on. If you look at Milton Friedman's world 50 years ago, and you think about what life was like for him, all right, it couldn't have been all that much fun. He had a very good life. I'm sure he was having fun. But think about how isolated he and F.A. Hayek, Ayn Rand, intellectual leaders of the free enterprise movement, how isolated they must have been in the mid-1960s. There were a couple of schools that were havens for what they were doing. But their ideas were viewed as complete quackery, okay? School vouchers. All right, is this guy smoking something? All right, the notion that the Federal Reserve should be put on autopilot and we should allow rules to trump discretion. What is this guy talking about, okay? Not to mention some of his ideas on poverty, okay? It's like basically what we now think of as the earned income tax credit and the negative income tax, okay? Ideas like this that were so radical at the time and that have now basically become mainstream. Even people like Larry Summers and Paul Krugman acknowledge that Milton Friedman changed their lives, all right? So the ideas that we see in Friedman have actually come with us to the present. And we have ideas and arguments that are still really strong, and they're more prevalent now than they were in Friedman's day. It's not like one or two kooks saying them. They've been taken into the mainstream to some extent, and you'll see people talking about Friedman's ideas at a lot of different places. And this is really important in terms of the advancement of economics. At the same time, so if you, there's three different parts to what I'm trying to talk about here. Ideas, resources, and then positions within economics. So on the ideas front, Friedman and his disciples, Friedman and Hayek, the Austrian school as well, the ideas are still really on solid footing. Okay. Many have said that the Austrian School of Economics, for example, is perhaps the only school that can explain the Great Recession of 2008. All right. So we're doing all right on the idea front. On the resources front, the free enterprise movement within economics has probably never been better. All right. Ludwig von Mises could hardly get a job when he was, and he was one of the top economists mid-century. All right. He could barely get a job in America. Hayek struggled and had to go to the University of Chicago and get help. All right, these are the leading intellectuals of our movement. Today, there are countless numbers of ways to get employed as a free enterprise economist. Okay, it's just it's bloomed and blossomed amazingly. All right, and the resource support that's available is something that I don't think many people can fully understand. When I was an undergraduate student about 20 years ago now, and I considered the possibility of going to graduate school, it's still, even in the late 1990s, early 2000s, was somewhat of a daunting possibility, okay? Because if you wanted to go to a place like George Mason, and if you came out of there as someone who proudly wore free enterprise ideas on their sleeve and said that these ideas really matter for our future, you were kind of at risk in terms of where you might end up. Okay, you could very well get pigeonholed into a few places in the country, and that was it. Now places like George Mason, 15 years later, are enjoying higher and higher levels of placement in terms of quality, higher numbers, and there are a lot of other schools enjoying the same kind of fortunes. So in terms of resources and outcomes, we're doing pretty well. Finally, if you think about positions, okay, the academic positions, this is what allows a movement to spread, academic positions. There were hardly any positions available for people like Hayek and Friedman, let alone Bollier, okay, in 1950, okay, 1965, I mean. All right, people farther down the food chain from the absolute best wouldn't have had a chance in the 1960s. People who are really important in communicating the ideas and principles that many of us in this room believe in. Now there are more positions than we've ever seen before. Just to kind of toot my own horn in the program that I run at the Johnson Center for a minute, I've been able to hire, besides myself, 8 other free enterprise economists into one department. Okay, so we're kind of the second largest cluster in the United States to George Mason in terms of the number of people who are doing work that's liberty related. We're not alone. There are a whole bunch of schools like us. There are probably 300 or 400 around the country where you have one crazy or more like myself, okay? And I'm saying crazy totally, you know, as like what other people describe me as. I'm not crazy, okay? So 300 or 400 different universities, okay, where we have actual exciting hope, okay? You have at least one lone wolf there who's willing to raise his hand and say, actually, Keynesian stimulus doesn't work, okay? Actually, the Federal Reserve being empowered as the strongest institution mankind has ever seen is kind of a scary idea. And we have this now like we've never had it before. So the future for free enterprise economics, even when the discipline of economics as a whole seems to be going this way, actually looks to be really robust. Part of it may be because the discipline of economics as a whole appears to be going this way. We may actually have some people out there who still want folks doing relevant work. I certainly see this every day at Troy University. Parents writing to me and saying, thank you. I'm so worried about what my kid's getting for an education. And parents single-handedly looking for places like Troy. So the future actually is somewhat promising when you look at free enterprise education in the United States. But it certainly isn't like this guarantee. The fact that we have people at a lot of places, that's just an input. How are we doing on the output side? And that remains to be seen, okay? We don't have Milton Friedman now, all right? We've got a lot of people who've been influenced by Friedman. We've got a lot of people trying to fill in gaps in certain areas, okay, whether it's drug policy or entitlements, pension reform, okay? But it's people who are basically filling in gaps, just like Friedman was doing with Smith. That's completely fine. But the incentives they face are ones we have to really be worried about. And this isn't just unique to economics. The incentives that free enterprise economists face and the incentives that people in the humanities face are ones that are strongly tilted towards careerism. So why don't I play the game of autoregressive roots and predictive regression, because that's going to get me to a really good school, all right? And once you start playing that game, it's really hard to remain true to who you are. So careerism is a tremendous concern that we all should have. We've done amazingly well since Friedman in getting positions, getting people, broadening the free enterprise movement. But are we sure that all of these positions are leading people to do the kind of work we want them to do? Are they concerned about changing the world, all right? If that's not their concern, we may need to focus some energy in the next 50 years on how do we get them focused on the right questions, the big questions. Along with careerism, I would say, just to return to Friedman in my final minute here, is that he was hammering on humility and the need for humility, and it's possible that we've shot too far as free enterprise economists in the direction towards being humble. We're so worried about offending, okay? We're so worried about being able to play the game at the big kids' table that we sometimes give away too much, okay? Or what we often do is feel guilty about a position we hold. So if you look at economists leading up to 2008, they actually were doing a pretty good job at making arguments in favor of less financial market regulation, okay? In favor of what we might say are free enterprise themes. A tremendous number of them flipped like that after the 2008 crisis. They got a little bit scared, okay? And they felt a little bit guilty about the positions they held. And this is something we're going to have to watch in the years ahead. I look forward to the discussion. I'm out of time, but I appreciate your attention this morning and welcome any questions in a few minutes. Thank you all.